In 1978, there was a very sick man doing some very sick things in Sacramento, California. This man believed that vampire aliens and UFOs were zapping him with beams. And these beams were not just sapping the life energy out of him, but they were drying out his blood and turning it into powder. The only way to keep his blood in liquid form, naturally, was by drinking human blood. This was not a criminal mastermind, to be clear. This was a very sick individual with profound and violent psychotic delusions. He followed these delusions and interpreted signs all around him. And these signs would lead him to select random houses. He would approach the house, walk up to the front door, and turn the knob. If the door was unlocked, he would go inside because he'd taken this as a sign that these people were selected to be killed so that he could drink their blood. However, if the door was locked, he took that as a sign that these weren't the victims for him, and he moved on. He didn't try to break in. He didn't even knock. He just tried the knob and then left. I tell the story a lot, especially to children, because the point of it is to always lock your fucking doors, especially when you're home. People lock their doors when they're gone, and the worst thing that can happen is you lose your stuff. You got to lock your doors when you're home. You could lose so much more. Now, that is a true story. This man, the vampire killer, did operate in Sacramento at that time. So I didn't make any of it up, but I also omitted huge chunks of the truth. I sort of shaped the truth into a story or a myth to make it more useful, to get the point across. Which got me to thinking that how much of history is myth, and how much of myth is history? There's a tremendous blurry line that separates fact from fiction, history from myth, truth from nightmare. And here are three more stories of historical horror that come from that blurry line. Drinking whiskey in the kitchen and telling scary stories around the fire. Music, monsters, and mayhem, killers, cannibals, and cults, fearful fiction and furious fact, tall tales, and terrible truths. This is A Scary Home Companion. There are two legends I want to tell you about the man named Duddy Bookman. One of these legends is rooted firmly in historical records, incomplete as they may be, and the other is from a much darker and uglier place. One legend shows Bookman as a national hero, a man who died trying to save the soul of Haiti. The other tells of a noble man who lost his soul when he died, and how that now he wanders the islands as the servant of an evil entity. Duddy Bookman was definitely larger than life right from the start. He's born a slave in Jamaica, and although he was large, physically imposing, he wasn't a bull, he was a scholar. In fact, he got into trouble for teaching the other slaves how to read. That is actually why they call him Bookman, because he always had a book with him, and the whites thought that was funny, so they just named him Bookman. But he ended up being more trouble than they wanted, so they sold him to a Frenchman who lived in Haiti. In 1791, Bookman presided over a huge voodoo ceremony. It wasn't just a ceremony. That's what I'm trying to get across here. Think of it more like the opening night of the Olympics. This was big deal stuff. He and a prominent voodoo priestess sacrificed an animal. They drank the blood, and then they issued forth a prophecy to the people that the slaves would revolt, drive out the occupiers, and reclaim Haiti for themselves. Now, If you don't think that he got his squad fired up from that pep talk, let me tell you the numbers. 1 week later, there were over 1,000 slave owners that had been killed at the hands of the revolution. Hundreds of plantations have been sacked and razed to the ground. And if that shit doesn't make you smile just a little bit, I don't know what to tell you. No. Live fast, die young, leave a beautiful corpse, as they say, because it was November of that same year, 1791, when the French killed Duddy Bookman. The man at this point, after just a couple of short months, had become so revered that the French had to sever his head and put it on display for everyone to see, because otherwise, no one would actually believe that Bookman was dead. Which, in its own way, is a belief that still lingers over 200 years later. If he was larger than life, he was most definitely larger than death. He was a symbol for the Haitian Revolution, and to this day is still beloved as a national and religious hero. Of course, there are rumors, there are myths, legends, and that's all these are, people. I was talking about the history. Now we'll talk more about the stories. Because, huge caveat, most of these legends no doubt derive from the white oppressors themselves, who tried every tactic they could think of to tear the man down, both before he died and after. To this very day, there are people, white American people, who say that Bookman was a devil worshiper and he made a pact with Satan for his country, which is patently foolish, of course. There was some talk that Bookman might have been a Muslim and that book he was always carrying with him was the Quran, but most believe that he was a voodoo practitioner. Either way, Satan isn't a part of the equation. The islands, they don't need Satan. They have their own devils, their own monsters. And while Satan might not have been a factor, the withered old visage of Tonton Macoute just might have been. Tonton Macoute, which stands for Uncle Gunny Sack, basically, he's a notorious boogeyman in Haiti. He walks the night with a big burlap sack over one shoulder. He finds wayward children, sticks them in the bag, and then takes them to the underworld. That's the bedtime story to keep kids in line. And one of the stories about Tonton Macoute is that one night he stole that severed head of Bookman and he put it into his gunny sack with the kids. And because of that, Bookman was eternally bound to him. So a man who championed his country and his people was now used as a ferryman to take the stolen children out into the Devil's Triangle. There are a couple major variants on this myth. I've heard it told that Macoute did this because he loves to take a noble spirit and to make it suffer. I've also heard it told more than once that it was never the real Duddy Bookman at all, and Tonton Macoute uses imposters and lets them take that name just to denigrate the name of Duddy Bookman. Yeah, those are just the stories. Truth is, he was a man of letters, a man of righteous anger, a man of revolution, a man of violence, a man who blurs the line between historical fact and historical fiction so completely, it's sort of impossible to tell where the man ends and the legend begins. Bye. Down here in the South, we have more than our fair share of colorful and creepy legends. An echo from one of my very favorites just came up a couple of weeks ago, and it's been rattling around in my head ever since. I have to share it with you. And I know, before you say anything, that it's probably coincidence. But come on. My show is so much more fun if you think that maybe it isn't a coincidence. So a reader sent me a news story from Atlanta where the police had found a wrecked car just outside of town. It had ran into an abutment and there was a man dead behind the wheel. The interesting thing happened a few days later when the cops changed the case status into a homicide because it turns out the driver hadn't died from the crash. He'd been stabbed in the heart before impact. Since the man didn't stab himself, but there was no one else in the car, my first thought, of course, was of the Southern gentleman. Okay, maybe some of you Northern folks need a little backstory. That's cool. The Southern gentleman is a traditional ghost story down here, dating back to the antebellum. It's about a spectral hitchhiker who walks and stalks the highways south of the Mason-Dixon. He's a scruffy-looking white man with a long coat, boots, and a cowboy hat, whose defining characteristic is his impeccable manners. You see, when you give a lift to the Southern gentleman, you better mind your P's and Q's, because anybody that doesn't abide by proper Southern hospitality will end up dead on the side of the road and waiting for a ride alongside the gentleman. The story itself, very old. The string of murders, not so much. This is just in the early 2000s, I want to say 2002, when an investigative reporter named Ed Rasmussen started writing a series of articles for an Atlanta newspaper about an alleged serial killer that he claimed was working the Deep South. Rasmussen found evidence of a series of automobile fatalities where the cause of death was not the crash, but that the driver had been stabbed in the heart. Seven different cases over three states going back 10 years. He named his phantom killer after the old ghost story. It only makes sense. Rasmussen speculated that since this was the sort of crime that could go undetected for years, that there might be more out there. I mean, the manner of death often blended right in with the gory mess left behind the wheel. The victims were never wearing seatbelts, so it was never a very neat crime scene to investigate, even if the people weren't burned up. If it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, then it's a duck. If there's a car crash with a dead body behind the wheel, then the death was caused by the car crash. Why look any deeper than that? Well, because of this mindset, Rasmussen speculated that there might be dozens more victims out there going back for years and no one would ever know. Things got ramped up a little bit after that when Rasmussen printed an interview that he alleged was with a survivor from one of these crashes. It was a little girl who had been in the back seat when her mother died. This girl said that she and her mother had stopped to pick up a hitchhiker. He was a tall man, she said. He had long blonde hair coming out from the back of his cowboy hat, and that he was very nice to her and took off his hat and smiled when he got in the car. It was only a couple of miles after that, right after they got up to speed, that this man pulled a honey knife out from his boot and stabbed the mother in the chest. And then he leaned into the back seat, and he used that same bloody blade to cut the little girl's seatbelt. And then he said, quote, "Hold on tight." So the car runs headlong into a wall. The girl, miraculously, thrown free of the car, although not without substantial injuries. She said that she couldn't move. She had multiple broken bones. The man walked up to her. He was bleeding from the nose and had a little cut over his eye, but otherwise seemed to be totally uninjured. And he sees her laying there. The man lit up a cigarette. He tipped his hat to this broken and bleeding kid on the ground. And he said, "Ma'am." And then he walked away. Great story, but ultimately never proven. Rasmussen refused to ever tell anyone the girl's name or anything specific about her due to her being so vulnerable. And this was just the sort of sensational but unverifiable story that played really well for a hot minute, but faded fast. It had no legs because there was no proof. The proof, such as it was, actually came out just a few weeks after that. The cops fished Rasmussen's car out of a canal. It was all smashed up. The reporter was still inside. Apparently, he had been stabbed to death before going into the water. Later that night, one of the cops on the scene told a local news crew that they had found an old cowboy hat laying in the passenger seat. He later recanted that story, saying he was just playing up the ghost aspect, but still, it really makes you wonder. Anyway, I've got my eye on this new case in Atlanta, and if I get any further incidents possibly involving the Southern Gentleman, I'm going to pass them right along to you.
Great to see you. Listen, you don't mind if I record this interview, do you?
No, of course not.
Terrific. Hey, go ahead and have a seat.
Thank you.
Can I get you a drink?
It's 10 a.m. and I'm at a job interview, so no thank you.
Okay. Teetotaler, that's okay. Let's just continue. It is March 13th, 2018. This is the final interview for Marianne Simpson for the position of field reporter for A Scary Home Companion. Listen, I'll just put it out here. We've talked online a few times. I've reviewed your resume, your education, your work history. It's all very impressive.
Thank you.
So my question to you, I guess, is why me? Why this show?
I'm sorry. I don't follow.
You went to journalism school, aced it, two internships. You could probably go somewhere and make some real money, something that I am not offering you. So why are you here offering to work for me for peanuts at a fledgling podcast?
If I answer, you won't use this on the show, will you?
Wouldn't dream of it.
Okay. Something happened to me when I was a kid. And the authorities couldn't explain it. And the doctors couldn't explain it. The more I read the facts, the less I understand it. So it got me thinking that maybe I have to look elsewhere for information or for answers.
Answers for what exactly?
Do you know Ed Rasmussen? He was an investigative journalist in Atlanta.
I can't say that I do, but I'll definitely look him up.
Well, I met him once, and then something bad happened to him. And it seemed like everyone tried to cover it up, and they turned it into a joke. Someone said a ghost did it.
Ghost. Okay, you can't stop there. I'm sorry, Marianne, I know this is supposed to be an interview and everything, but you can't just leave me hanging with half a story. What happened to you?
Okay. When I was a little girl, my mom and I, we picked up a hitchhiker.
Some months ago, I had the opportunity to sit down and talk with an old man, a retired Army vet, who had served as one of the tunnel rats in the Vietnam conflict. Now, I don't know if you've heard about the tunnel rats before. They're a hardcore group of infantry soldiers that served in the tunnels underneath Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. There were not just U.S. soldiers, there were also Australians and New Zealanders that served in the tunnel rats. Because the Vietnamese army decided to press every advantage they have and to start digging these tunnels underground. And only the bravest and craziest soldiers were willing to follow them down into that darkness. There are several different documentaries about the tunnel rats and a lot of books. And I have to say that as a student of history, that anything that you can read or watch about the tunnel rats is going to be worth your time. These are some of the most interesting and colorful and batshit crazy characters you are ever going to find. The motto of the tunnel rats was non gratis anus rodentum, loosely translated, not worth a rat's ass. When I spoke to this old man, he told me the single most interesting story I've ever heard about the tunnel rats, and I've heard a few. And this is one that you can't find in any documentary or in any book. The stories that we're all told that we hear about the Vietnam conflict usually focus on the horrors of war, and for good reason, but there were other horrors there too. Ones much older and more dangerous than any invading army could ever be. The most fearsome demon in Vietnamese mythology is called Suong Kuong. And you're going to have to pardon the butchery of that language. Let's just roll with it. I'm doing my best, okay? Suong Kuong. This demon started out as the most wondrous and gigantic tree in the world. It had branches that reached so high that it threw shade for thousands of miles in every direction. Eventually, like all things, it grew old and sick in both body and spirit. And when it died, it transformed and turned into a demon that feasted on human suffering and flesh. The rulers of Vietnam battled with this demon for decades before finally tapping out, giving in, and making a deal with it. They would offer up one human sacrifice each year, and the demon could feed on that flesh, but only that flesh, and then he would have to leave them all alone until the next year. And it worked for a while. but not long, because there was new leadership with modern thinking. And as is the case a lot of times, modern thinking overtook the old myths, because modern thinking puts principle over practicality. And without his yearly tribute, Suong Kuong went ballistic and started maiming and killing and eating the Vietnamese people with abandon. The new leadership ended up choosing to go old school. And so the emperor brought in the best and most powerful and most educated and most pious holy men and shaman in all of Vietnam. And the battle between these men and the demon was epic. It was one for the ages. They could not kill it. Even with all their combined power, the demon was just too strong to be killed. But they did manage to lure it underground and bind it there, trap it with spells, and to make sure that it could never come back over ground and harm the people of Vietnam, these spells made the demon vulnerable to both sunlight and water. And there Suong Kuong stayed for quite a while. Fast forward a few centuries. The country of Vietnam is divided. It's a war zone. Pure pandemonium. The people have taken up arms against one another. In the course of doing whatever it takes to put up the W, the Vietnamese soldiers became adept at tunneling. They had the intimate knowledge of the land in order to make it their biggest asset. And after a while, when our boys realized that they were doing so well, Uncle Sam decided that we need to send some of our best and brightest down there. Because whatever you can do, we can do it a little bit better. And these were the tunnel rats. The toughest, the most hardcore, the most badass, fearless, ferocious sons of bitches that wore fatigues. They would spend days on end silently crawling through long, intricate webs of tunnels, earthen walls pushing up against their shoulders, pinching them so tight that they had to belly crawl, moving inch by inch through the mud and the dirt in the pitch black, surrounded by bugs and snakes and literal tunnel rats. And worst of all, these soldiers were looking for an enemy that not only knew the tunnels better than they did, but had dug the tunnels themselves and set all manner of booby traps along the way. That, to me, sounds like the basis for a horror movie right there. But the tunnel rats, they lived for this shit. They were legendary. They were legendary soldiers. They were legendary survivors and legendary killers. But what they didn't know, and what the native Vietnamese people did know, was that you can't dig down too deep. Because when you go too deep, then Suong Kuong can hear you. And if he can hear you, then he'll call out to you and he'll lure you down towards him where he is trapped. And make no mistake, even though he is trapped and bound and vulnerable, this is a very powerful demon. The things that this demon can do to the human mind, the pleasure and pain that it can inflict, is not to be underestimated by any mortal. The Vietnamese tunneled carefully, with skill and knowledge and purpose, because they knew better than to dig too deep or to get too close. Our boys, the tunnel rats, on the other hand, they didn't know about the demon. And if they did know about the demon, would they have really cared? Let's say that a friendly had tried to explain this demon. What hard-headed, red-blooded U.S. soldier is going to listen to that old wives' tale? What tunnel rat would not go down into the tunnels because there is a scary demon down there? And so the rats actually pressed this to their advantage. They went deeper. They got bolder. They got bloodier. They went places that the Vietnamese wouldn't dare go. And in the process, they made a lot of noise. And in the process, they caught the attention of the demon. A lot of, meaning most of the former tunnel rats, all reported at one time or another seeing and hearing things down there that they couldn't explain. And this is chalked up to stress, of course, because who wouldn't hallucinate horrible things in those circumstances? Just seems like a logical place for the human mind to go. But there were a handful of the rats, and these were all notorious tough guys to start with. Tougher than a $3 steak, as they say. But some of the guys, the ones that went the farthest and the deepest, they never really seemed to come back. Not all the way. The other soldiers could see it on them and in them and behind their eyes. And so the whispers started to spread through the boys that if you go too deep, what comes back may not be you. Not all the way you, you know? Eventually, the time came for the troops to be withdrawn from Vietnam. And the tunnel rats were some of the first to be pulled out of the field. And for good reason. With service like that, heroism beyond the call, these fellas all deserved a fast track back to the States or whatever country they called home. But here's the thing. Some of the tunnel rats didn't come back. And when the orders came down for everybody to evacuate, these guys dug in deeper. These guys started stealing supplies and weapons from their friends and fellow soldiers and squirreling them back down into the tunnels way down deep. This old man that I talked to, this vet, he told me about a buddy of his. And he'd been serving with this guy side by side, shoulder to shoulder, inching through these tunnels for the last few months. The old man I talked to, he couldn't wait to get out of that country. But his buddy had to be dragged away physically. He was deranged and shouting. They actually caught him stealing a bunch of rucks from the other guys and stuffing them down one of the tunnels. He was jabbering the whole time. He was nuts, frothing at the mouth, talking crazy about some sort of open door and the thing on the other side that had heaven in one eye and hell in the other. I think that's what he said. They dragged him away and loaded him on a chopper. Then a couple of the boys went back to try and grab those stolen rucks. The old man told me that when he crawled into this tunnel and stuck his head down deep, he saw several familiar faces looking back up at him. And these were all boys that he knew and had known for months to be smart and strong and brave and patriotic and devoted to one another. But here there were over a dozen of them, and they'd all stripped naked and smeared mud all over themselves. They were crawling through the dirt. He said they were moving unnaturally, almost like animals. And they pressed themselves into the walls, and they crawled into the dirt. And it looked like they were going gladly. He'd never seen anything like it. He would one day, but at the time, he hadn't seen anything like it. To this very day, the legend of Suong Kuong is still very much alive in the new and modern Vietnam. Only now the story that they tell to their kids is a little bit different. Because now that vicious demon has an equally vicious pack of followers. And these guys aren't bound and trapped to stay under the earth. These guys can come to the surface and do the demon's bidding. They tell their children that these men are so pale and white that they look like ghosts, but so emaciated that they look like skeletons. They're naked except for boots and machetes, with animal skulls for helmets, and necklaces made out of knuckle bones and ears. They call them the White Devils. They say they have napalm for blood. They come to the surface for one reason, to drag the weak and the unwary down below so that the demon can once more feast on human flesh. These men went overseas to fight evil, but they ended up staying to serve it. The ghosts of Vietnam still haunt the world in more ways than one. Really, who's to say what's myth and what's history anyway? Did Washington actually cross the Delaware? Did Mark Antony actually come to bury Caesar? Did Hitler actually kill himself in a bunker? Did John Wilkes Booth actually escape because of those mysterious cybernetic legs of his? I wasn't there, and neither were you, so how can either one of us say for sure what really happened or how it happened? History is written by the survivors, but it's published by the winners. So what we consider history, what we consider fact, these are just the things that we have all chosen to agree upon. Of course, we can only agree upon the things that we know about. So the secrets, the whispers, the legends, the myths, the dark scraps of the world that are hidden away, some of them might be just as factual and just as much a part of history as anything else. You just don't know it. And if that's not a mission statement for the whole damn show, I don't know what is. Thank you for listening to A Scary Home Companion. Music this week was provided by Chelsea Oxendine, who provided the opening theme and the opening song. The song La Tapienda that accompanied the Bookman story is by Bo Marley, Disrupt, and Volphonic. The song that accompanied the Southern Gentleman story is Ho Harp by Lobo Loco. And this ill outro song is called White Guy Disease by the Drunken Foreigner Band. Links to all of these songs and these artists are available in the episode notes. Check them out on Free Music Archive. Send feedback to the show at ascaryhomecompanion@gmail.com, or you can find me on social media. A Scary Home Companion is on Facebook, and on the Twitters, I am known as Nateflix. Can't forget my associate producer and fledgling T-Bone Burnett impersonator, Jeff Davidson, who helped me put this all together.